Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR news, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio broadcast and online stream, Main Street, across North Dakota this time of day. And today we'll start our show talking about North Dakota's State Hospital in Jamestown. The hospital is one of the issues being debated in the legislature. There is interest in building a new hospital, and of course, we'll find out about what kind of work, what kind of patients are treated at the state hospital with Dr. Rosalie Etherington. She is the state hospital superintendent. Thanks for joining us, Rosalie.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Leslie Scarborough is the North Dakota State Hospital Director of Nursing. Thank you for being with us, Leslie.
And thank you for having me.
Rosalie, what is the mission of the North Dakota State Hospital?
The mission of the hospital is to serve as a specialty safety net hospital for the state of North Dakota. And because we are a safety net hospital, we provide multiple different types of services. So although we are the local community hospital for the Jamestown and the Devil's Lake region, we also serve as that specialty service for other private psychiatric hospitals. Approximately 41% of our admissions come from other psychiatric hospital settings. For clients or patients who have not improved adequately in those other settings, and therefore they come to us for further stabilization and rehabilitation. In addition, we do serve a small set of individuals for court competency restoration and for treatment of individuals found not guilty by reason of insanity. And then we have two specialty residential services, including residential treatment for the sexually dangerous, and residential treatment for specialty substance use disorder treatment.
So how many patients do you have?
At any given time, we have approximately 140 individuals that we serve. We have just 100 hospital beds. And so within our inpatient facilities, we vacillate between 65 to 100 individuals served at any given time on the campus. Most of our admissions and discharges come from that service. So we generally, this is not COVID times, but generally we have approximately 900 to 1,000 individuals served in that setting per year. And then in our sex offender treatment program, we currently have about 34 individuals confined. We have several others that are on community release. And then at the moment, we have an approximate number of 36 residential substance use disorder treatment beds. And those are generally full. So although they may vacillate between 80 to 90% occupancy, mostly full.
I was surprised. You said something that I didn't expect, that the state hospital is also a community hospital for Jamestown?
Correct, for the Jamestown and the Devil's Lake region. So we are the only psychiatric hospital in that geographic area.
So that's the specific specialty we're talking about here. We're not talking about people coming in with, who've fallen and cut themselves or something like that.
No. Although we do a lot of medical care on our campus, no, correct. It is not a general medical facility for the Jamestown area.
Is the nearby James River Correctional Center a completely separate facility, or is it somehow connected to the state hospital?
It is a completely separate facility, although on the same general campus. So it is half of the campus is the James River Correctional Center, and the other half is the hospital.
Leslie, you're in charge of nursing at the state hospital. How many people do you supervise?
I directly supervise 12 individuals. However, there are around 300 nursing staff that will report up through the chain of command to me.
And is there much turnover among the people that you are dealing with?
No, our turnover is really excellent. We lose a few people here and there to retirement. Occasionally, someone leaves to a new employment. However, our turnover rate is, I can't remember the exact number, but it is really low. It's lower than anywhere I have worked before.
But you're looking for nurses or professionals to work under your supervision. Why?
Well, we have vacancies. So even though our turnover is quite low, our clients that we serve, of course, have needs that need to be met. So we have vacancies in the area of RNs in particular, but of course, CNAs or what we call DCAs, direct care associates, to serve those clients. And it varies depending upon the needs of those clients. So some are more acutely ill than others, and sometimes that requires more staff to serve those folks. So really dependent upon the needs of the clients, but we do have vacancies that we need to fill. And of course, we compete with several different agencies throughout the area. So we need to get that word out there and bring some excellent people in.
Now, you've got a job fair plan, don't you? Tell our listeners about what you're planning.
Correct. We have an immediate interview job fair, or a walk-in interview is what I like to call it. And we are going to hold that actually today from 2 to 6 p.m. at our Learning Resource Center here on campus. We will also be doing open interviews or immediate walk-in interviews Monday, April 19th, as well as April 26th. Same time, 2 to 6, same location, Learning Resource Center on campus here at North Dakota State Hospital.
Dr. Etherington, the state hospital's been around for a long time, since the late 19th century. And obviously, some of the buildings have aged not terribly well, and your capacity has been tested, I assume. You're looking for a new state hospital. What's the argument, besides what I just posed?
So the argument is multifold. So in addition to the aging infrastructure that's degraded and has approximately $148 million of deferred maintenance backlog, we are providing patient care in three different buildings. And a new hospital built with healing architecture would provide us one hospital building that would not only economize staff, but could provide better care.
So what is healing architecture?
So healing architecture is the science around what type of healing environment is necessary to help patients recover faster. So we know that natural light, access to green space, actually speeds recovery, reduces hospital stays. And you can imagine with aging infrastructure, we have long, dark hallways without natural light. We have patient bedrooms, not much of which also have natural light. We have a lack of green space. And we have what's called social crowding, which is on small units, you have a lot of social density, and it actually can prompt a lot of agitation and aggression. And so in new healing hospitals, there is a 50% reduction in aggression of patients based on good design.
That's a pretty compelling argument right there. Dr. Rosalie Etherington is the state hospital superintendent. And Dr. Etherington, what's the total price tag for this new facility?
So we do not have a firm cost. We have an estimated cost of approximately $150 to $160 million. And that is dependent on the size of the hospital. It's also dependent on if we co-locate the local community mental health center with the hospital. So we have proposed that we build a hospital and an outpatient clinic. And that, of course, would drive that price tag a little bit higher. But we would, it is still, although a little higher than the deferred maintenance, it is less costly over the life of the loan or the lease of that new hospital. Because, again, if you think about the aging infrastructure that we have and the multiple buildings, some of which need to be destroyed, we are taking care of buildings that we no longer use, and we're also taking care of old buildings that will require replacement of mechanical, electrical, and plumbing systems multiple times over the next 40 years.
Now, there's a House bill, 1012, that has been discussed and I think recommended for a study. What's the current status of your proposal in the legislature to get a new hospital?
So the Senate's Appropriations Subcommittee did vote on our 1012 last week, And although it remains as a study for a new hospital, we will be going into, they did add money for that study, and therefore we will be going into the Senate and House combined committee for the purpose of further debate.
Okay. So stay tuned, I guess. The decision is not yet done.
Correct.
Leslie, is the work of a nursing staff member at the state hospital or, you know, these direct patient care people, is it potentially dangerous or is it like a hospital?
You know, I think anywhere you go in healthcare, there's potential danger. You know, we always risk some kind of exposure. So along that same lines, of course, you know, there are some risks involved. However, the training that is provided at this hospital is specialized. We have a specialized team that works on what we call therapeutic options and on motivational interviewing. They are trained to de-escalate situations that might happen, so it doesn't happen. We have an amazing team of nurses and direct care staff that are well-trained, they're experts in their field, they know exactly what they're doing, and they train new people that come on board. Additionally, we have a nurse that is our educator, our full-time educator that has been on the unit for, I think, 30 years, who is leading the charge to orient our new nurses. So like everywhere else, of course, there's risk. However, we are the best trained staff that I have seen getting ready to go into a new position.
Well, a lot of brand new hospital and clinic facilities have been built in the state of North Dakota, including one not too far from the state hospital. Is the current condition of the state hospital a barrier to hiring?
I think logistically, when we're talking about having clients in three separate buildings, that can be a deterrent because logistically it would be easier to hire staff, train staff to be kind of right in one area. I still think that our training is bar none, along with our benefit package here at the hospital. You just can't beat it when you're talking about 100% premium paid health care insurance for family and staff. A retirement that's 11% of gross income. We've got paid sick leave. We've got paid vacation. We've got 10 paid holidays. Pretty awesome benefits. So,
I'm on my way.
And Doug, if I may, although as Leslie identified, multiple benefits and great staff to work with and work for, the aging infrastructure of our campus, as she indicated, the care in three different buildings is a barrier. But we also know that the science around new hospital settings predict that satisfaction for staff increases, satisfaction for patients increase, and the retention of staff actually increases. So the general healthcare turnover is approximately 20%. Although North Dakota State Hospital's turnover rate is hovers around 14 to 15%, the research would suggest that the turnover actually reduces all the way down to 7% in a new hospital setting. So I would hope that we could even improve it further by having a new hospital.
You mentioned a couple of areas that the state hospital is particularly suited to serve, that is drug and alcohol abuse recovery, and sexual crime issues. Obviously, with the drug and alcohol thing, there's typically a time limit. There's a set amount of time that people go through treatment, as it's often referred to. What about sexual crimes? How do you assess whether somebody's okay?
Our specialty residential service is for the sexually dangerous. And what I mean by that is that there is a higher level of acuity and a higher level of need for the individual with a sexual disorder that also commits sex crimes, and therefore the length of stay for treatment is much longer. On average, across the nation of similar programs, the length of stay is approximately 5 to 7 years. The length of stay at the North Dakota State Hospital for that same care is approximately 4 to 5 years. So we are a little bit below the national average, And it is because of the aggressive treatment approach that we have, very similarly to our inpatient services, which has a much lower length of stay than it did even 20 years ago. So we have the same amount of admissions, but half the beds, and therefore people come and go rather quickly. But our length of stay in sex offenders is much longer.
And what would be the longest stay? Is it potentially a life term?
Potentially a lifetime, correct.
Does the state hospital have a cemetery?
The state hospital has two cemeteries. Our first burial was in 1885.
What role did the North Dakota State Hospital play in the state's pandemic response? Because I know it was all hands on deck for a while, especially last fall.
Oh, correct, Doug. We were the only psychiatric hospital in the statewide bed surge plan, and we were identified as that specialty hospital for individuals that are served in the three specialized care facilities for geropsychiatric care in the state. So we have one facility in Dickinson, one facility in Valley City, and another in Ellendale. So those three specialized care facilities serve geropsychiatric patients, and we were identified in the bed surge plan if an individual within those facilities is diagnosed with COVID, and they actually came for their medical care at the state hospital. We have served over 80 individuals with COVID over the course of the pandemic, some of whom were just admitted to us, and we identified their COVID positive at admission, and some, of course, came from those nursing homes already tested positive.
And Leslie, what about your staff?
You know, like everyone else, we had staff that fell to COVID, and they were off of work for the required 14 days, and then our building was required to test. So we did weekly testing there for a spell until we got zero positives, which was just a couple of weeks ago, and we were able to move to testing every 2 weeks. And we've also immunized a good portion of our staff. About 65% have the COVID immunization, so we're thrilled about that.
Leslie, what drew you to this place of work?
You know, I've had family members that have had mental health issues. So it has always been kind of close to my heart to help people and also to see them transition into the community. I think a big important role that we often don't think about for our nursing staff is what a huge part of the integrated care team they are. They assist their clients in rehabilitation and getting to the point where they can transition as much as possible, as much as they can, into the community and have as normal life as they possibly can. That's huge for dignity, respect, all of that stuff. And I've always been one that has said, if you take care of the patient or you take care of the client, everything else is going to work out. And our staff, our care team, our nurses, our direct care staff, our medication assistants are 110% dedicated to their clients. They work tirelessly to meet their needs and do the best that they possibly can for them to give them as normal life as possible. And I think that is just so admirable. I am so very proud of the staff that we have here.
Dr. Etherington, you've been there, I learned, 23 years. You started as a psychologist, you became clinical director, and now you're the superintendent of the hospital. What brought you there?
Actually, two reasons brought me there, the first of which was coming back to North Dakota as a long-term resident. I left California to come back home. And the second reason, the most compelling reason, was the services to the severely mentally ill. So when I, after my graduate degree out in California, I was serving in the public mental health sector and have a love and a passion for rehabilitative care of people with severe and persistent illness.
Dr. Rosalie Etherington is the State Hospital Superintendent. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Leslie Scarborough is the State Hospital Director of Nursing. Thank you, Leslie.
Absolutely. I thank you for your time.
Natural North Dakota is next.
Support is provided by Villa St. Vincent, the Summit of Crookston, where health, independence, and choice come to life through short-term care, rehabilitation, skilled nursing services, memory care, and assisted living. A member of the Benedictine Health System, villasaintvincent.org.
If you feel cooped up, cut off from friends, Americans a century ago were feeling the same way.
It is not that fun to be quarantined. It's not that fun to not be able to leave your homes. And so people are anxious to get back to regular life.
A history lesson in pandemics and human nature, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is a naturalist and the writer and voice of our Natural North Dakota essays. We're transitioning into spring, and that may mean cleaning up our property for the new growing season. Well, Chuck says the cleanup plan should include consideration for the insects and birds that share your environment.
We're coming up on spring cleaning time, if it's not started already. It's time to do some outdoor yard work and the like. But when it comes to clearing out those old dead or dying trees and branches, you might want to reconsider, unless there's some potential for damage to person and property. It might surprise some of you, but those dead and dying trees are prime real estate for a wide variety of organisms, ranging from slime molds to insects, birds, and mammals. They're particularly important for cavity nesting birds that rely on the holes in trees, both living and dead, for nesting sites. I recently saw a book by the U.S. Forest Service that listed over 80 species of birds that utilize or excavate holes in trees. As you might expect, the list includes a few species of ducks, such as wood ducks, buffleheads, golden eyes, and hooded mergansers, as well as hawks, particularly the kestrel or sparrowhawk, plus owls and woodpeckers. The list also includes some species of flycatchers, swallows, various warblers, wrens, and bluebirds. Those dead and dying trees are important to a lot of birds and other organisms. Relatively healthy trees may contain some cavities, of course, but cavities are more prevalent in dead and dying trees. As most everyone knows, most people promptly remove any dead and dying trees from their property for safety of people and property. However, as we learn more about the ecological importance of these trees to biological communities, we may want to rethink things. At least save a few, if possible. So what is a standing dead or dying tree worth? The savings of not cutting it down certainly comes to mind. Plus, many of the same birds that excavate or utilize tree cavities feed on insects. As such, these birds may serve an important ecological service by helping keep some insect pest populations from erupting. Estimating the economic impact of these services is difficult, but it appears that there's some economic benefit. Plus, of course, there is the aesthetic and ecological value of the birds and other organisms using them and our enjoyment of watching them. So make a point of noting the dead and dying trees and branches in your area as you enjoy the outdoors this spring and summer. Odds are that they'll be receiving good use from some birds and other organisms. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, April is Fair Housing Month. We'll talk about fair housing law with Kelly Gores with the High Plains Fair Housing Council after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A bill to prevent the governor or other state officials from imposing a mask mandate as a health protection is now on its way to Governor Burgum. That after the House agreed with the Senate changes to the measure. As introduced, House Bill 1323 would have prohibited state and local officials from imposing a mask mandate. The Senate changed it to state officials only. Bismarck Republican Representative Jason Doctor told the House this is a reasonable compromise.
The mask mandate is a local issue and it will stay a local issue in this bill.
The bill's main sponsor, Minot Republican Representative Jeff Hoverson, agreed.
We have two options. Do we trust 750,000 people interacting with each other, the medical field, and educating themselves to navigate through hard times as we always have? Or do we trust the blunt force of a mandate?
The House vote was 67 to 24. The House has also passed the budget bill for the State Department of Transportation. In that bill is legislative intent language that DOT use 15% ethanol gasoline and biodiesel blends for its vehicles. Some lawmakers raise questions about that intent language, but Edgley Republican Representative Mike Brandenburg said language of this type was added to the DOT bill several years ago to encourage a 10% ethanol blend.
Today it's proven that it has work and it works in the gas and actually E15 blend is cheaper than the E10 blend, as well as it's about, with the non-ethanol added, it's about 40 cents cheaper.
And Rugby Republican Representative John Nelson told the House Agriculture Committee is still North Dakota's number one industry.
Nearly 50% of the corn that's grown in our state is turned into ethanol, which produces income for farmers and revenue for the state of North Dakota. So any encouragement that we could use to in the state fleet, I think is good encouragement.
The House passed Senate Bill 2012, 81 to 10. It will now go back to the Senate for further work. And the state Senate has approved the K-12 funding bill. It includes an increase in the per-pupil payment of 1% for each year of the upcoming biennium. That tied to the requirement is 70% of the new money must go toward non-administrative personnel. Here's Bismarck Republican Senator Nicole Poolman.
Teachers, paraprofessionals, bus drivers, custodians, lunch ladies, and others who have made learning possible in the year of the pandemic will see a raise in the next biennium.
Poolman says with the passage of that budget, North Dakotans will spend $2.9 billion in the upcoming biennium.
At a time when learning recovery will be the next pandemic challenge schools and families face. The funds and policies passed during this session will undoubtedly support their efforts and the success of North Dakota's kids.
The bill, House Bill 1013, passed 44-3, and it will now go back to the House to see if that chamber agrees. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Kelly Gores. She's the Associate Director of the High Plains Fair Housing Center, and she is speaking to us from her office, relatively new office in Bismarck. Thanks for being with us, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
Remind our listeners about the High Plains Fair Housing Center. What is it? What does it do?
We are a private nonprofit, and we work across the entire state of North Dakota with the mission to ensure equal access to fair housing. We do this through training, education, a bit of enforcement, and one of our most important pieces is advocacy. So we let people know what their fair housing rights are in North Dakota. We do a little bit of enforcement with our testing program where we make sure that housing discrimination is occurring and we can make that stop. And we also do advocacy where if somebody is experiencing housing discrimination, we can either mediate with them and their housing provider, or we can assist them in filing a formal complaint with HUD or the North Dakota Department of Labor and Human Rights.
You're a private nonprofit. Do you interact with state agencies who have a common interest?
We do. One of our strengths across the state in all aspects of this kind of work and any kind of interpersonal work is that there are a lot of people involved in assisting people. When we do file complaints, we work with people and the North Dakota Department of Labor. So we kind of act as, we're not lawyers, but we act as advocates, so we can assist them in their housing discrimination complaint and interact with them and the Department of Labor or HUD. We do also partner with the North Dakota Housing Finance Agency with training and letting housing providers know what their housing rights and responsibilities are as well. So we do interact with a lot of government agencies and other nonprofits as well.
The Fair Housing Act became law in 1968, so it's over 50 years old now. Mm-hmm. Is there a proper definition for fair housing?
Sure. The Fair Housing Act protects people from housing discrimination in any kind of housing transaction. So whether they're renting or buying a home, whether they're in the process of getting a mortgage or even seeking some kind of housing assistance or basically engaging in any kind of housing related transaction or activity. The Fair Housing Act protects you against discrimination because of your race, color, national origin, religion, sex, familial status, or because you have a disability. And familial status is just being discriminated against because of the presence of children in the household. The Fair Housing Act covers most housing. There are some exceptions, usually for owner-occupied housing units of like four or less units, or if you're selling a house without using an agent or any kind of advertising, you're exempt from the Fair Housing Act. But pretty much most housing transactions are covered by the Fair Housing Act.
Now, the Fair Housing Act is federal law. Does North mm-hmm. Dakota's fair housing provisions differ in any significant way from the federal law?
Fair housing, federal Fair Housing Act, you can kind of think of as the floor. So everybody in the nation is protected of those seven protected classes that I just mentioned: race, color, national origin, religion, sex, familial status, and disability. But states can add additional protections, and in North Dakota, we do have additional protections. So you kind of think of those as a ceiling. So beyond the federal protections, we have protections of discriminating against people because they receive public assistance, because of their age, if they're over 40, and because of their marital status.
Is there a problem with fair housing in our state?
There is. I think this is, you know, I've done education and outreach and done trainings for housing consumers, landlords, social workers across the state now for over 4 years. And almost every time there's a, this doesn't really happen in North Dakota question, right? And unfortunately, it does. One of the main groups of people in North Dakota who are discriminated against are people with disabilities. Also nationwide, over half of all fair housing discrimination cases filed with HUD or our Department of Labor are for disability statuses. And that's often because the Fair Housing Act, while it protects you against kind of that differential treatment in housing because of your protected class, it also allows people with disabilities to ask for reasonable accommodations or modifications in their housing so that they can use and enjoy their housing equally as people without disabilities. So it's kind of removing those either policy barriers or physical barriers in their housing. So an accommodation is asking for a policy change that is keeping you from using and enjoying your housing like everybody else because of your disability. And this is where we think of emotional support animals coming in, but also things like somebody who might have had a disability where they had to live with a family member for a couple of years, they can ask for an accommodation in the application process of that, like, rental history. If they didn't have that 5-year rental history because of a disability, they can ask for those accommodations. And then people can also ask for physical modifications in their housing units, where if there's something where there's not a curb cut in, you know, to get into their housing, or it's within their unit where they need maybe their counters lowered or cabinets removed because of a physical disability, that's something they can also, they're also protected for to be able to do in their housing because of the Fair Housing Act.
Well, a curb cut or, you know, moving cabinets can get kind of expensive. Who's responsible for that?
Good question. If it's private housing, so if it's just a private landlord, the tenant is responsible for making the cost of making the modification. The landlord just has to allow them to do it. If it's something where it, if it's a curb cut or something that should have been built into the housing, so the Fair Housing Act also includes design and construction requirements. So there are things, if a building was built after March of 1991, there are physical things that must be included in the housing, and a curb cut or and something like that is included, or having, you know, accessible handles or outlets that are reachable at a certain height off the floor. Those kind of things, if that's not the case, then the even a private landlord would have to pay to kind of get those up to the standards that it should have been when it was built. Otherwise, the tenant pays. If there's any kind of federal dollars in the program running of the housing, like a housing authority building or any kind of housing program that's run with federal dollars, or any federal dollars were used to build the housing, so if you did get federal grants, if you did have home funding, that kind of thing, where federal dollars were put into building the building, then you are, it kind of kicks into a different federal law where that landlord would be responsible for making the modifications and paying for them.
Are accommodations for disabled people required in new rental construction, you know, bigger apartment houses?
Yes, any kind of housing, even if it's after 1988, any housing transaction, and this could even be in a sales process, if there is something that, if there's a rule or a policy that is a barrier to somebody because of their disability, they can ask for that accommodation, and it's up to the landlord to grant it. And if they can't grant it, if it's something that's unreasonable to be granted, it's up to the housing provider to enter that interactive process and find out if, okay, if this doesn't work, what else can we make work? But yes, if there's a disability-related need or a change in a policy or a rule or a modification, it's up to the housing provider to allow it or enter that interactive process to find out what else can be done.
Now, is this something that should be considered for new single-family home residences or condos or anything like that? And what I'm getting at is, you know, 20 years down the line when you want to sell the house, will it be required that you have accommodations for people with disabilities or service animals or whatever?
Right. Is this for multifamily housing?
No, single family homes.
Single family. So the accommodations and modifications apply to multifamily housing. I apologize for not making that clear.
No, you made that clear. What I'm getting at is this something that might be worth considering in the future for a homeowner, for that matter, just to make it easier to sell?
Absolutely. When we look at our aging population, having things like step-in showers, having one, single-level flooring, those are things that people might want to think about as they age or as, right, when they want to sell their home, having those accessibility features are definitely helpful. Or having, wider hallways, things like that in new housing is something that would make it better down the road when you're selling it, yes.
Kelly Gores is Associate Director of the High Plains Fair Housing Center. They have offices in Bismarck and Grand Forks, and their mission includes advocacy, education, and enforcement. Kelly, how do fair housing complaints get to you?
One of our challenges is making sure people know we're here in North Dakota and we can assist them. We do have an intake line. People can call our intake line at 701-203-1077, and you leave a message with what's happening to you and your contact information, and an intake specialist will call you back and kind of walk you through your housing situation at the time and see if it is something that is discriminatory and we can assist with, or if there's another agency that might be able to help you better if it's not a Fair Housing Act type issue. So they can call that number. They can also call that number. Right now we have an eviction assistance program for people in Bismarck, Fargo, Grand Forks, and Jamestown. So if you are being evicted for non-payment of rent right now with the CDC eviction moratorium, we can assist you. If you're being evicted for non-payment of rent and using your rights to put the paperwork through for the CDC eviction moratorium, or possibly connect you with a lawyer to help with that. That's kind of a little extra thing right now that we have going on, but you can also call that intake line to assist with that. Or you can go to our website at www.highplainsfhc.org. And you can file a complaint on that website. Any other way you can get a hold of us, if you are find us on Facebook, you can send a message through that way too. So yes, get a hold of us and we will have an intake specialist call you back and find out if we can help you or who could help you if we can't.
Well, you just mentioned the pandemic has kept a lot of us working differently than we had before. How did it affect your intake line?
Our intake line was not affected at all by the pandemic beyond getting an increase in calls in 2020. So we did have a 55% increase in calls on our intake line, but those people were already working from home. The rest of us had to adapt to working from home. So that was a bit of a challenge for us, but our intake specialists, they were on it, and we didn't have much of we didn't have any kind of interruption in that intake process. So we were thankful for them.
Well, if you get a call and it's a fair housing issue that you can confront, what can you do?
We can do multiple things. Sometimes people just need to know their own rights and they want to exercise them, so we can educate them to know what their fair housing rights are and how to exercise them. We can advocate for them. So if they call us and they're having an issue with their landlord, or they feel like they were discriminated against in a mortgage transaction or a sales transaction, but they need to get that housing and they don't want to file a formal complaint, we can mediate between them and their housing provider. And we do that more than we help people file complaints. So we had last year, we helped we filed 15 complaints as an organization, or assisted people with 15 complaints, but we had 123 of those mediation type resolutions, because a lot of people don't want to go through a formal complaint process. We can help mediate between them and their housing provider and get the solution they need. But we can also, if they do want to go forward with a complaint, we can advocate for them, so we can kind of be with them. We're not lawyers, but we're advocates, so we can kind of walk them through the formal complaint process so they can file with HUD or our North Dakota Department of Labor and Human Rights. And we can kind of be with them on their phone calls. We can help them get their paperwork together, that kind of stuff. So we can just be their advocate and walk with them through that complaint process and be with them and assist them if need be.
Kelly Gores, you mentioned the website. It's High Plains F, as in failing grade, hc.org. And I went up there and I was looking at some of the sheets you have, information sheets, which really shed a lot of light on what your rights are and what course of action you may have open to you. I was surprised to see what I should have been aware of, but there are barriers to renting to women who are victims of domestic violence and assault. Why are there?
So this is something that HUD in the last 3 or 4 years has really pushed for, to make sure that people understand that sex discrimination includes harassment. This is something where somebody is in a vulnerable position because either they are a victim of domestic violence and they need to get out of their housing or find new housing, or that they are in a vulnerable position where they might be a single mother or a single woman who, especially with the pandemic, we have seen this exacerbated, where people are being propositioned for sex favors, for rent, that kind of thing. That is something when somebody is in a vulnerable position, they can't pay their rent, or they are a single woman or a single mother. That is something that we do see. It's not anything we like to talk about as a society, but it is there and it's present, and it is protected under the Fair Housing Act. So under sex discrimination, intimidation or harassment under any protected class is protected under the Fair Housing Act as well. But yes, there, if you are experiencing harassment, sexual harassment, or being positioned, or that kind of quid pro quo where people are asking you this for that kind of favors, even if you succumb to that, even if you haven't paid your rent, you're still protected under the Fair Housing Act. So we can assist with that as well.
One of the things that caught my eye about this issue is that obviously landlords can do some kind of a background check, and they can find out if you were in a housing situation where there were a lot of police calls, and there would have been if you were being assaulted or in a dangerous situation. And so perhaps the landlord doesn't want to inherit that police problem. So that it's kind of a double-edged sword. There's a victim, and then there's a landlord who doesn't want to inherit the victim's problem. That's a catch-22, a real complication, it would seem to me.
It is. So there are protections built into our Sentry Code. There are things specifically that don't necessarily relate to housing discrimination, that if you are a victim of domestic violence, you can get out of your housing situation or, you know, terminate your lease early without getting those extra termination fees. If that's the case, that's something, you know, there's specific things in our law. But it within that domestic violence protections in our North Dakota Sentry Code, there is also a piece where you cannot discriminate against somebody because they have been a victim of domestic violence. So we can assist with that as well. And it's important to note, too, that the Fair Housing Act, when passed, is the only type of legislation that has a dual purpose. And that's not only to eliminate housing discrimination itself, but also to affirmatively further fair housing, so to make it where we are not just ending housing discrimination, but we're also making sure that we are actively integrating our societies and actively making sure that people are protected. And with that, you know, housing discrimination, we often think of differential treatment, where somebody's being treated differently because of their race, color, because they have kids, because they were a victim of domestic violence, that kind of thing. But it also protects against disparate impact. And you hit the nail on the head when you talked about a policy where, you know, you might not allow somebody who has any kind of criminal record or these kind of nuisance orders where three strikes, you're out. You get evicted because you've had the police called on you, and that is a disparate impact to victims of domestic violence. Absolutely. So that is also protected under the Fair Housing Act.
And this is Fair Housing Month, and you are observing it with some Fair Housing Friday events. You've got one coming up this Friday, Asian American Discrimination Discussion. Why is that an important discussion to be having now?
That is a discussion that, it's important to have any time, for sure, Asian American discrimination. It's not one that is highlighted often, and I think because of recent events with the Atlanta shooting, that this really has kind of come into focus, where people might not have thought about this kind of discrimination. And with COVID, Asian people are being harassed because they are believed to have brought the virus, or because of the virus coming out of China, there's a lot more harassment coming around COVID-19 related issues. So we really want to make sure that people understand that not only is this an issue that we deal with here in North Dakota, but just to kind of highlight that this is an issue that Asian Americans deal with, and it's often kind of, when we talk about discrimination, it's often overlooked. So we just want to bring it to the forefront. One of our board members is a proponent of making sure people understand Asian American bias and Asian American harassment. So she's going to be joining us, as well as another North Dakota resident. And talking about this kind of harassment, the Fair Housing Act does protect people based on their national origin. So if it, this kind of harassment is happening in their housing, which we have seen with COVID-19, or if any kind of national origin harassment is happening, the Fair Housing Act protects against that. So that's part of why we are highlighting this issue, as well as making sure, just bringing awareness really to this issue and have that discussion of the historical context of the discrimination and how to address these issues going forward in North Dakota.
And next Thursday, that's April 22nd, you'll be viewing or showing the Jim Crow of the North film and having a panel discussion. Jim Crow of the North is a film that was produced by Twin Cities Public Television a couple of years ago, and it talks about redlining and the rental and housing discrimination against African Americans in Minneapolis particularly. But it talks about racial covenants, and the interesting wrinkle in that story is that Fargo and perhaps other communities in North Dakota had deeds that had racial covenants written into them. So this is something old and something current.
Right. We often try to use Fair Housing Month to really highlight why did we get to the point where we needed the Fair Housing Act. And racial covenants are a big, big part of that story. Racial covenants and redlining and federal policies that made it so people of color basically couldn't get any kind of federal assistance in the 1940s and 50s when there was a real push after World War II to get people into single family housing. People of color were left out of that, and they were their neighborhoods were left out and were actually put, they call it redlining because actual maps of cities had red lines around them where federal dollars did not go, were not allowed to go. So in the Federal Housing Administration did not allow them to have federally backed loans, like these loans that we think of that kind of built our middle class in the 1950s, people of color were left out of that wealth building part of our history.
And the federal, state, and municipal governments were complicit until that Fair Housing Act in 1968. And of course, we're still dealing with the reverberations of all of this. Kelly Gores is the Associate Director of the High Plains Fair Housing Center. Thanks for spending time with us today, Kelly.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Dakota Date Book is next.
Hearing Voices.
Hi, I'm Julie. I'll be able to help you look up schedules and fares for any Amtrak train. What city are you departing from?
I don't know.
Go by train. Railroad journeys.
Well, the long and the short of it is, one morning around 3 a.m., I bet Bukowski I could drive a diesel locomotive. And he takes the bet.
So all aboard with Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices coming up Tuesday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 12th. Western history has a way of making legends out of men or animals, and sometimes it's difficult to separate the facts from legend. On this date in 1936, one such legend was roaming the Badlands of the Kildare Mountains at the head of a herd of cattle. Known as Traveling Jenny, she was the monarch of the plains and belonged to the William Connolly spread near Kildare. Traveling Jenny was believed to be one of a number of super cows, a cross between a Hereford and a buffalo. She had the heavy shoulders and chest of the buffalo and the white face of a Hereford. Her shaggy coat allowed her to withstand the severe cold of the open range, and she preferred to sleep in the snow rather than seek shelter in a barn. She held the undisputed reputation of being the strongest, fleetest cow in the western part of the state and was always on the move, hence the name Traveling Jenny. In 1936, she was the head of a herd of semi-wild cattle that mingled with the 700 head on the Connolly Ranch. William Connolly was one of the pioneer ranchers of the state and had recorded the first brand registered in North Dakota, the Two Bars. Connolly had been a cowboy near Medora in the early days and had ridden with Roosevelt. At one time, he had grazing rights to 70,000 acres and ran up to 2,000 head of cattle. He began his career in the days of open range ranching. Texas Longhorn were the desired breed, and a few stray buffalo still roamed the plains. The Texas Longhorn soon gave way to new breeds, and Connolly had been one of the leaders in promoting Hereford cattle. Traveling Jenny was the offspring of one of these Hereford cows and a stray buffalo. She belonged to the two-bar spread, but William Connolly was unable to enforce his proprietary rights because there was no barn, fence, or building able to hold Jenny. William Connolly died in 1946, and history does not reveal what happened to Traveling Jenny. But if you happen to be driving out along the rugged hills of Dunn County at about sunset and see a swirl of dust in the sky, that could be old Bill Connolly and the Two Bars hands still trying to put a brand on Traveling Jenny. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
China relied on millions of delivery workers while the country was in lockdown. One of those workers spoke out against poor working conditions and was arrested.
That is a red line for the Chinese government. Anything that coheres collective power for workers is seen as a threat to state power.
A labor activist vanishes on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast on the radio, we also stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, we'll talk about a program called Sources of Strength, which aims to improve overall well-being for students at Minot Central Campus High School. We'll talk with Program Director Jennifer Harbaugh. And horticulturist Ron Smith will join us to talk about dry weather challenges for gardeners. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.